Good evening. You're either listening to or watching Redwood Walk. I'm with David Frank. My name is Eric Kirk. We're discussing national news, political news of the day. And I mean, probably the biggest story over the past week outside of the what's happening in South Korea, which we discussed last week, is the story in Syria that just turned into one of the fastest regime collapses in history, maybe rivaling the collapse of the Afghanistan government during Biden's time. Well, actually, we're still in Biden's time. We had a civil war that has gone on for over a decade, over 600,000 deaths by some accounts, possibly even more. You had this regime was opposed by a broad coalition of opposition reminded me of the FMLN of El Salvador in the 1980s. I mean, you had the Islamic revolutionaries, you had more secular pro-West people, you had the Kurds, which represent the last truly secular left-wing force in the region. Some of the soldiers, Kurdish resistance, referred to themselves as anarchists. And then you've got the political intrigue of the Kurdish nationalist movement that spans over four countries, obviously one of the biggest chunks in Syria, and a breakaway group from Al-Qaeda took the initiative as resources were being drawn out of Syria by Russia. And Hezbollah was weakened in its war with Israel. Iran is weakened. And basically, Assad, the regime, after 50 years, including his father, just all of a sudden didn't have the foreign support to prop him up. So it's collapsed. And Assad is now taking asylum in Russia. A new group is coming in, and the new leader, we will talk a little bit about him, but he is formally self-identified as an Islamic radical. He's through interviews in which he's very articulate and very much coming across as a moderate, is trying to reassure people that this is not going to be Afghanistan or Iran circa 1979 or any of those. And he's actually said, like, for instance, one statement that the regime made about women dressing is that we hope that traditional values will be respected. I'm paraphrasing, but there shall be no government rules imposed on how anyone dresses. I mean, a remarkable statement to make. Words are, of course, words. We'll see if it really happens. And one CNN reporter, a woman, said that when she went into the palace to interview some of the people who were occupying it, the soldiers from this group would not acknowledge her until she put her garb on. So, but that they weren't forcing her to. They weren't ordering her to at gunpoint either. So we don't know what's going to happen with this group and with the coalition in general. There is still some fighting between the Kurdish groups and the Turkey-backed group. There's so much to talk about, but then there's the statements that Donald Trump has made. Now, he's perceived as being a close ally to Putin, as we've discussed on this show. Putin, definitely, this is not a good look for him, either internationally or domestically. He did not really stand by his ally. He did some bombing, but that was about it. And of course, he's inside. He's allowed the leadership into his country. But Trump issued a social media statement saying something about, Russia. He actually said three times, Russia, Russia, Russia. It's a weird thing. It has not been able to provide the support to him. He pointed out because of a weak economy and an ongoing war with Ukraine. I thought that was an interesting thing for him to say because he usually doesn't criticize Russia at all. Maybe that's not really criticism either. I don't know. But and then Tulsi Gabbard's basically saying that she has a history with Assad and a really concerning event last year where children who had been bombed by the government, you know, said they were bombed by Assad. And she says, are you sure it was Assad? Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of other things going on. I can go on and on, but we want to focus on what is the domestic impact and what is Trump's line going to be with this new regime? And I guess it depends maybe on what the regime looks like and how Putin reacts to it in some ways. But Dave?
Yeah, thank you for that setup, as always. I think, you know, you and I have alluded to this on the over the last year and a half, I suppose, as we've talked about the ongoing and evolving situation in Israel on their southern border with Hamas and on their northern border with Hezbollah, that this region is filled with strife and that regional strategic interests of the United States are larger than discrete interests related to the two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. I think this is a manifest example of that for us. Number one, about how we really do need to think more broadly about the region and again, U.S. role and interest, but also about how it evolves and can evolve very quickly. And sometimes there are things that are outside of our radar, but also outside of the radar of the, you know, intelligence and professional foreign policy communities, too. From what I've seen, there was not a lot of advance warning here. I think we will learn that the transition between Biden and Trump had a lot to do with Turkey's decision in how they were going to react in their support of maybe some proxy forces of theirs that were in Syria. Also, you know, the whatever back channel conversations were happening with Putin, you know, he and Russia sort of overtly not no longer being the defender and of the Assad regime in Syria. Again, I think there's a lot that's still left to unpack as more information comes out. But it really was the perfect storm. You know, Western sanctions did devastate not just the Syrian regime, but the Syrian people, their livelihoods and well-being. I think
90% poverty rate, I think. Yeah,
exactly. You read my mind. I was thinking that I saw the same thing. And also the fact that, 6 million people estimate 6 million Syrians have fled the country and dispersed across the region, but also into Europe to a certain extent, disrupting their immigration policies and their own domestic politics all the way up into Scandinavia, including Germany, including border countries all over Europe. So it really has been not just a regional conflict, but there are global implications here. And as we speak now, and I know we're going to try to pivot to what are U.S. domestic interests and where are we going to go from here as we transition from the Biden administration to the Trump administration. But I think it's worth noting that as we speak now, there are currently five countries engaged in bombing operations across Syria, trying to establish some new kind of equilibrium. So that's the U.S., Israel, Turkey, Iran, and Russia. They all have different factions, just, you know, across the, because Syria is a relatively big country, 26 million people. If you look at the list of different groups that were allied against the Assad regime, it's several dozen different groups. And so there are, I think I saw today that nine different bases across the region that a U.S. general had gone through to speak to U.S. commanders and also Kurdish troops. So, you know, not to like attack this with like a sort of a shotgun degree of focus, but a scattered focus, if there's such a thing. But General Kurila, that's the Kurdish autonomous region in Syria. It's along the Turkish border. So those Kurdish SDF troops are under fire, not just by Turkey. And again, there's a lot of things that aren't clear in the fog of war, but also Turkish backed rebels. So just as a reminder, I think, because we are trying to pivot to what are U.S. core interests, what could the Trump administration expect in the near term? It really does go back, I hate to say it, but to Sykes-Picot, the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and the drawing of the lines and the decision not to create a Kurdish nation, but instead to disperse the Kurdish population across Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Iraq. that's still in play. That's like the United States is still allied, or sorry, is currently allied since the Iraq war with Kurdish folks, Kurdish interests, Kurdish territory and troops. That's across both Iraq and Syria. So even though Turkey is in NATO, there's a little bit of a distance between the Turkish national interest and the U.S. strategic concerns. That's in the northern part of Syria. But along, I think key here, I'm pivoting because what's going to take precedence, I think, in the halls of power in D.C. Is really that Israel-Syria border. So the Israeli interests, we'll get into it. I'll hand it back to you before I dive into the Israeli interests, but I just want to frame it as weapons have flowed from Iran through Syria into Lebanon for many years. And now with this regime change, it nearly zeroes out the capacity for Iran to use those same supply lines. So it really is a regional war, hot war, that this transition in the United States really did have a lot to do with the timing of this new momentum that ended up with President Assad exiling into Moscow.
Biden's official statement says, make no mistake, some of the rebel groups that took down Assad have their own grim record of terrorism and human rights abuses. We've taken note of statements by the leaders of these rebel groups in recent days, and they're saying the right things now, but as they take on greater responsibility, we will assess not just their words, but their actions. But a lot is going to happen now. We aren't seeing where they are. There was a little bit of looting early on, but what is now the Syrian military replacement military has prevented that, and without being brutal about it, apparently. So there still is the luxury garage of all these really expensive cars, Lamborghinis, cars I hadn't even heard of, that are there, and they're still intact. The reporters have been allowed in to see it. And of course, the decisions are going to have to be made, but the new leadership wants to make it in an orderly manner. The reporters going on the streets are not being impaired at all. There's really no sign of anything really bad happening yet. Now, obviously, this country's got to stabilize. Israel isn't helping. It's bombed, made hundreds of bombing runs now, taking out certain weapon systems and the rest, and some of them right in Damascus. I wish that, Biden had the guts to tell them to stop, because a destabilized Syria is not good for anyone, not even Israel. So they've consolidated even extended a little bit beyond Golan Heights. I get it. But the United States has also been bombing ISIS, but only ISIS and only outside of the cities. I don't know if they're still doing it, but they were doing it before the rebels went into Damascus. So what is the United States' response going to be? I don't know. Biden's people are really trying to work with Trump's people to come up with a coherent approach to this as it evolves. Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just know we only have 2 minutes left, and okay. There's a lot here. So I'll just try to give 1 minute for two different thoughts each. One is that, there was a 13-year civil war, and for the last 6 years, this jihadist groups and that civil war included Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the KDS, Kurdish Syrian Democratic Forces, and then other groups that morphed into other groups and splintered groups. So it was a whole menagerie of groups. But for 6 years, this particular group that marched into the capital, they were, kind of isolated in Idlib on that northwestern border with Turkey. And Assad's troops were prevented from going in there to fight them because of the protection of Turkey to the north. And so this group, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, it used to be al-Qaeda in Syria, but they've rebranded. So their leader, Abu al-Jalani, he currently still has a $10 million U.S. bounty on his head. They still are considered terrorist group because of their extreme tactics. So in order for any kind of normalization to occur, there has to be some, you know, massive agreement about who it will be, under what aegis, and what the agreements and the arrangements will be. So that's why I think that explains why Jelani's media charm campaign has been underway. He gave a statement saying that diversity is strength, and they're going to have a new salvation government with no religious persecution of Christians, Druze, or the Kurds. So true diversity and strength, it's going to take some kind of reassessment on their part to be anywhere close to, you know, what Western view of that means. So words have different meaning. You know, we have to be really careful about that. Also, Jelani started granting amnesty to Assad soldiers, police, and security forces. He's got a campaign to begin administrative services like garbage collection, called Together We Return, trying to get some of the money and the people to come back and restart to rebuild the country. They've taken the barricades down. They've cleared the roads to allow communities that have been isolated from each other for many years or more to begin, you know, reconnecting. So the long war against the Assad family is over, but this new transition is only just begun. And I would say that was maybe a little more than a minute, but I'll try to just keep it to just 15 or 20 seconds on the second topic. You had mentioned it's not clear, it's not a coherent strategy. It's because it's so complex and there's so many competing interests. But Israel has basically been exercising their right to defense, they're calling it, by moving into the Golan Heights. And just as we want to talk about, say, Donald Trump for a little bit here. Donald Trump has said that the Golan is that territory will belong to Israel during his last administration. So during the last Trump administration, he already gave that section over. Well, that's been occupied by a buffer zone since the 1974. Ceasefire agreement, formally ending the war with Israel and Syria. So we're talking 50 years. There's been a buffer zone in there that now Israel has breached and kind of expanded upon in the name of self-defense.
They were just taking target practicing Syrian troops with artillery with the town. So
it's bigger than that, though. They took out chemical weapon sites, radar installations, air bases, naval bases, weapons facilities, civilian airports that are dual use. And their strategy is called to create a sterile zone. So Israel is really massively impacting Syria's capacity to project power, which for the medium term prevents a jihadist group from having access to advanced modern weaponry. And I think that's why the Biden administration is really not saying much right now. They're giving Israel the capacity to defend itself over the short to medium term.
Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy.
We are going to raise issues that, you know, historically have not been raised.
What about the nuclear option, doing away with the filibuster? I can tell you that would be the end of the Senate as it was originally devised.
All of this is possible for America. Who was standing in the way? Mitch McConnell.
Where an insurrection that sought to overturn an election, when that failed, the action moved into state capitals.
So we know that Jack Smith is having all of the charges, federal charges against soon to be President Trump, dropped for the reasons that it is the policy of the Department of Justice not to prosecute sitting presidents. And there isn't expected to be a lot of will to keep the cases open for 4 years in that context. And one of the cases has already been dismissed. They'll probably just abandon that appeal. But in the states, there is no federal jurisdiction. And of course, in what the state charges against Trump are in New York and Georgia. Georgia is already an appeal for a real dumb thing about the prosecutor herself as to whether or not she can be involved with the case. And we've talked about that in great detail. But a motion has been made to dismiss that on the basis that he's the president and shouldn't be facing or worried about prosecution. In New York, he's already been convicted. 34 times with 34 convictions, and we've just been waiting to hear sentencing. But of course, the president probably isn't going to be incarcerated. So President Trump has made a motion to drop it. His attorneys cited Joe Biden's statement on his pardoning of his son Hunter Biden on this has to end or something like that. And so basically trying to make a call for unity and the rest. But a jury came out of their time, risk death threats and everything and possible lives to come up with this, to sit through a trial, and they rendered a judgment. And so the prosecution and a lot of other people, their position is that this was justice. You can't just, it's one thing to dismiss a case, but to dismiss convictions. We're not even sure about, whether the law even allows for that. Bragg has said that he's open to keeping, just holding off sentencing for 4 years. And that is a very likely outcome. The motion to dismiss was taken under submission. We're still waiting to hear it. It could come tomorrow. It could come 2 months from now. It could even come while Trump is president. I think the maximum time he has is 90 days. So, but I'm sure he'll decide that before that. But the basis is, hey, I'm the president, so you can't have convictions against me or anything like that. One thing I am afraid of is some of us who are skeptical as to whether Trump ever intends to leave power, leave office. Well, do we want to have those pending sentence factoring into his incentive one way or another? Just a point. But again, verdicts were rendered. We also want to talk about the cases against some of his allies that are in the states. Trump is going to pardon everybody, but for the federal charges, but he can't pardon anybody for state crime. Or state charges. The 10th Amendment prevents that. There is no ability to do that. So I understand you've got some comments on that, but maybe just comment on what you think, particularly the New York case.
Sure. So I think that's interesting. That's an evolving situation where you have the prosecution saying that, look, there's already been a conviction. Let's just postpone the sentencing until after the presidency is complete. That way justice will be served based on the outcome of the case. But we now know that Trump's legal team is filing to have even that dismissed, saying that it shouldn't be legal for these pending sentencing decisions to be made during his presidency. But Bragg and the prosecution team, they've pushed back that there is no constitutional grounds for these claims. So it's a series of tit for tat. Trump's basically saying that his election, this is a quote from the prosecutor, Trump's suggestion that his subsequent election superseded the jury's verdict is deeply misguided. As this court carefully and correctly instructed the jury, it was the impaneled jurors who were deciding whether the defendant is guilty or not. It's really trying to uphold the rule of law, and we'll see how it goes. I think interesting is that two of Trump's lawyers in this case are being considered nominees to his administration. And so it's one of those things where it's going to remain overtly political. I don't claim to have even a sense of how it's going to play out. Because it's just this is uncharted territory, to be honest.
Very few countries have a rule that a standing president can't be prosecuted. Netanyahu is being prosecuted in Israel as we speak. The trials continue. They get breaks and they come back. The president of Korea, although the impeachment failed because his governing party leader pulled a McCarthy and reversed himself within a few days, on everything, but he is being investigated now and could face charges even while still president. We are, without the impeachment, we are the only country that, well, not the only country, but one of very few countries that have taken this approach. It boggles the mind because we profess to be the most democratic country in the world, the one that respects that we're a nation of laws and not men. But more and more decisions are being made by the Supreme Court and by Department of Justice policy and the rest that basically make him out to be a ruler consistent with, the Hobbes Leviathan of absolute power. I mean, it's just it boggles the mind that has happened in this country where other countries say, no, if you're a president, you're still subject to the law.
And to be fair, we are talking about the hush money case, which I think from the public interest perspective is the least interesting and least important case. But the matter of principle still stands. Trump's team is trying to file motions to dismiss. They did motions to delay until after the election.
Right.
And so they did get to postpone that September, I think, 18th sentencing. And they were also postponing the November 26th sentencing because of Trump's team saying, hey, we're filing motions to dismiss. So it really does look like in a best case world for the prosecution, the judge and future appellate judges and Supreme Court judges will allow justice to stand in that case. But I think that's the least interesting case. So I'm going to pivot a little bit to the overall consensus, I think, is around the Jack Smith case, that federal case that's already been dropped. But the nature of that case is really racketeering. It's that there was a collusion of effort across multiple states to interfere with the legal transfer of the will of the domestic, the state specific election results and those electors making their voices formally heard at the Capitol for the peaceful transfer of power. So what we're seeing, because you had asked, like, let's talk about the state issues here. I think that federal case, we've seen a similar RICO statute filed down in Georgia and all the implications of the mess that's happened down in Georgia. But, there are several people that have already pled guilty down there in Georgia. But now, now they're looking to actually have those pleas overturned. So, for example, one of Trump's attorneys, Chesbrough, he pled guilty. But now he's saying, oh, that plea is invalid. You just need to toss this whole thing out. So it's going to be, again, it's going to be these motions to dismiss. And they're in. And so Georgia.
Bizarre motion, because it's based on the fact that, yes, I pled guilty. But after that, Donald Trump was elected president and therefore I should be, done. And he can't pardon me. So you should just drop my case. I mean, it's just bizarre.
Yeah. And so there's like 18 people down in Georgia who are being, charged with participating in a scheme to illegally overturn the election. But some of those people have pled guilty. But now they're saying, well, actually, now that the federal charges are dropped, there is no conspiracy. And in fact, the whole thing needs to be thrown out. So I'm kind of using that as a pivot to the other states, because truthfully, like right now, we have what is really interesting is the Wisconsin charges. So just this week, new charges, 10 additional felony charges. Yesterday, as we have this conversation, it's all such a blur. Wisconsin filed 10 additional felony charges against two of Trump's attorneys, saying again that they were and an aide to President Trump at the time, his election transition leader. I could get his exact title, but staff member, as part of a plan to submit paperwork falsely claiming that Trump won in Wisconsin when he did not win in 2016. So the, according, 2020. Yep. So each of those 11 felony charges, they face up to 6 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. These are new charges that just went into place. And that's for Chesbrough, this gentleman named Troupas, these two attorneys, and also a staff member named last name Roman. So these people, the issue is that basically they're saying this whole process of trying to do this bait and switch where you take the electors, this false slate of electors, come up with
fraudulent paperwork that you're going to then transition and hand over to Vice President Pence. They claim that there's enough evidence to show that such a plan exists. And in fact, lots of these people were on TV saying that they did this plan. So I don't know how they could claim they didn't do it.
And it was in Eastwood's memo in his emails. That's exactly what they were supposed to do. So
in the paperwork, in the prosecutor's new filings, they're trying to say, hey, the reason we didn't try to punish the electors themselves is because when the Wisconsin State Attorney General's office asked these electors, what was your role in this process? They said, hey, we were told that if it was the case that the Supreme Court found that there was election interference in Wisconsin, that we would then be plan B. So when this is what their claims are, according to the prosecutor, those electors are saying, hey, when we signed those documents, we didn't actually, we weren't committing to anything. We weren't claiming anything. We didn't consent to these documents being presented that Trump had won, unless there's a court ruling that said he won. So the Attorney General's Office of Wisconsin is saying, hey, we're not charging these electors. We're charging the people who put those pieces of paper in front of them and who said, who tried to initiate the plan. And I'll say this one last thing, and then I'll pass it over to you. It turns out what I think was really interesting is that one of Trump's attorneys, last name Troupas, he's already filed 4 motions to dismiss. That's what brings this whole thing together. They're already filing motions to dismiss ahead of tomorrow's hearing, right? As we are speaking, today is Wednesday. Tomorrow is the day, which is the day that this is all going to be in court, or at least the deadline for these filings. And so we could get into some of the specifics, but it's really interesting that their motions to dismiss say basically the first motion is that the reason we did this is to preserve the legal options just in case it went to the Supreme Court. But no crime was committed. Therefore, the complaint has to be dismissed. That's one. And two is federal law takes precedence. So therefore, these charges can't be state charges. Number three, they're claiming that because no crime was committed, there was no crime even mentioned in the complaint. So in fact, that anything, dismiss the complaint because it contains no crimes. And then the fourth thing that they're saying is prosecutions for election crimes aren't even state crimes. They're county DA crimes. So therefore, the attorney general's claims have no merit. Therefore, it should be dismissed. So they're going full court press, no pun intended, on these motions to dismiss. Pretty much, I think, thinking that eventually they'll get to the Supreme Court and they'll just wash it all away.
Or at least that's what they're hoping. But that can be lead to some interesting precedents. I think that, there are a couple of members of the SCOTUS majority that is worried about precedents like this. I mean, way back when in Bush v. Gore, when they basically created a safe harbor process that Florida's legislature hadn't, and then said, and this is strictly construed to the facts of this case, no attorney should be citing this case as precedent, people still cite it. Attorneys still cite it. You can't issue an order like that. If it's either good law or it's not, you can't, if you want to overturn your own decision, then you can say it's not. And so they do it all the time. And it has led to results that were not intended by SCOTUS, where courts have imposed their own. Well, the law should have this. I mean, that's what conservatives used to refer to as judicial activism. They don't use that word much anymore, that term. So, but there's a lot to be considered, too, as to whether or not these people can get fair trials without, for instance, bringing Trump in as a witness. Ollie North, who was convicted of unlawfully destroying documents right when the investigators were in the building in kind of a comical scene, where his investigators were coming in, they were carrying the documents out to be shredded. He was convicted of that during the Irangate controversy. I don't remember exactly why he said that he needed President Reagan as a witness, but the fact that Reagan could not be compelled to come and testify was basically used as a basis for overturning. So will these cases get a similar impact or be dismissed on the basis that Trump can't be compelled. And he's certainly not going to volunteer to go and testify under oath. So we'll see. But Ollie North was charged again federally. States might have their own thing. And the Supreme Court going, the Supreme Court can only take 150 cases a year at maximum. And the vast majority of those cases aren't political in nature. There's business litigation that's important, litigation pertaining to evolving concepts of trusts as opposed to probate. All kinds of cases. They can only take on so many Trump cases. And they are already have indicated that they're kind of getting tired of us dealing with this stuff. So, yeah, possibly the Supreme Court could overturn these guys, but you're not guaranteed, going before the Supreme Court. You have to be granted certiorari. Will they bother to do that? Will they accept those cases knowing that they have very limited time? So this brings us to Luigi Mangione. I hope I'm saying that right, but I tend to mangle things, especially Italian. But he is accused of having shot and killed a medical coverage CEO. In New York, he was caught by a customer at McDonald's who recognized him from the news. And he is being quite the character as a criminal defendant, yelling weird things to the press and everything. But the interesting thing is that he has an online following. There are people who are saying, I mean, people I know who say, well, why are they wasting so much time tracking down this one individual when, you know, people like, and I'm forgetting the name of the CEO already, have resulted in many more deaths than just one. And so you've got a lot of people and billionaires and CEOs in these companies are kind of shocked that, wait a minute, why are we being blamed here? You know, well, because there are millions of people across the country who are very dissatisfied with our healthcare system and particularly the insurance healthcare system. So he's been treated as a folk hero among the internet. I'm not going to go into all the details, but as we're learning more about him, you know, people on the left who thought he might be a hero are learning that, hey, he's somebody who probably really likes Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson, right? So he's not as much of a hero. He's being tarnished. But I want to go to an article about that I will suggest. It's Wired, and it's entitled "The Internet's Obsession with Luigi Mangione Signals a Major Shift." And part of the article goes through how maybe he's lost his luster with people on the left and right and in the dark corners of the internet and the right. But he says this, they say this perhaps makes Mangione's milkshake duck moment. I should qualify, milkshake duck is a reference to somebody who becomes a hero on the internet, but then his popularity declines as they learn more about him. This perhaps makes Mangione's milkshake duck moment not quite a milkshake duck moment at all. Yes, people are reevaluating how they perceive Thompson's suspected killer and his motivations, but they're not totally abandoning him entirely. That's redundant. Wired should know better. When the police released his mugshot late Monday, given a fuller picture of the good-looking person from the photo authorities had released prior online, thirst was everywhere. Fan fiction writers remain at work. Etsy is full of murk. It's wild how he's getting kind of the Billy the Kid or what was the couple played by Robert Redford and Paul Newman?
Butch Cassidy
and Sundance Kid, popular criminals, right? Although I don't know if they became popular until after the movie, but that's a whole other story. What is going on here? What does this? Is this all anger against the industrial medical complex, whatever we want to call it? What is the story here, Dave?
I think there's a quote from the New York Police Department internal report that really just nails the zeitgeist here, which is their consensus from looking at his notebook and the online information that they were able to glean already. This is, again, you can link through this through the New York Times. It says that the suspect saw this act as a symbolic takedown, and he likely views himself as a hero of sorts who's finally decided to act upon injustices. So, I mean, I think it's as simple as that. And there's another element to this is that he shouted about, like, on his way into court, he said that this is an insult to the intelligence of the American people and their lived experience. So basically, it's big picture. It is what it seems like. The absurd reality of our current medical system. So you can be in a doctor's network 1 year, but not the next. You got to try to, the rejection rates are very high depending on insurers. United Health Insurance current CEO is claiming that this is misinformation, but there is a reputable source out there saying that they deny on first claim 32% of their claims. Maybe it's not exactly that, but if the industry average is even close to the 17% that this one study pointed to, that's nearly one in five of all payments to doctors are denied on the first pass. That's absurd. So then you got to try to get someone on the phone, a human being. People are saying, there's a report out there that the new AI that they put in place to review claims is as high, the rejection rate is as, up to 90% of the AI rejections are overturned when you get on the phone and ask a person if you could get them on the phone. So that's a systematic absurdity. Coverage of care and prescriptions are often denied without so much as an appeal with any real prospects of getting heard, even though or getting realized, even though a doctor says that the care is necessary and the patient wants the care and the insurance has been paid. It's not like there's any gaps in that process. The gap is simply in the business model itself. The business model for insurance is delay, right? And that's what was on the bullets. Let's take it one step further. There's a saying out there from a famous book about the health insurance industry, and the shooter put it on the bullets: delay, deny, depose, which is the phrase used to describe how insurers dodge claim payouts. So there are a lot of people leading up to this event. There are a lot of people who already have internalized some rejection of the current system because of its inherent absurdity and without prospects for change. So that now fast forward to this murder.
I just want to echo something real quickly. As an attorney who's had to deal with insurance companies on all different kinds of levels, I can tell you they're worse than government entities in terms of trying to get something done. And they are absolutely it's horrible. Adjusters are trained to just treat everything as fraud, everything. And it is really bad. And I hope I'm not getting someone killed by pointing this out, by increasing the anger. But yeah, I mean, I've come to the conclusion that we just need to ditch insurance, private insurance altogether, and move to social medicine, not even single payer social medicine. But that's being said, I don't think it's right that people are making light of a murder for this, but I understand the sentiment.
Yeah, I think the angle you and I are taking is, why is he now appeared to be a folk hero? We're not condoning murder. That's exactly you led me right to what I was going to say, right? This week's fatal shooting of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, it was murder, and under no circumstances is an unjustifiable murder legitimate. Now, if you are a soldier in an act of war, if you are someone who wields a gun as part of your job and you have legal protections for killing people, then that murder may be justified. But certainly this murder is not justified, for what it's worth. So the question is, realistically, maybe it's the case that people already know. If you look at survey research, people already, I think the number's like 70%+ of Americans realize that this model doesn't work. That when you are required to have an intermediary whose sole responsibility it is to deny coverage, deny care in the name of cost rationing, it's outlived its usefulness to families who expect that when they play by the rules and pay their bills and buy the insurance that they need, that the care will be covered. So this has unleashed a wave of resentment. The resentment was already there. This has unleashed a wave of anger. The anger was already there. You name the verb or the adjective or the adverb. American, that's what this murderer, alleged murderer said, was that, you know, it goes against our collective shared experience. So that's what's happening, is people are venting about their shared experiences, about their interactions with insurance companies. It's a faceless, distant force that is really a result. I think the last number I heard was 64,000 deaths. God knows how many people defer their health care. If you look at bankruptcies, medical bankruptcies, depending on the study, between 40% and 60% of all bankruptcies in America are because of medical bills. So it is impacting the lives of majority of the American families. So I have some ideas about the takeaway, but I'll let you go if you have any additional insights here about the folk hero aspect in the face of the absurdity of the system.
I just want to go back to read another passage of Wired, because this is what happens with the internet. People pored over old X accounts and GitHub pages that appeared to belong to him. A thorough investigation of what seems to be his Goodreads account showed that he read Michael Pollan and Aldous Huxley. He had an Ivy League education, but he also might have been a fan of Joe Rogan and/or Tucker Carlson. What some folks online had imagined as a left-leaning anti-capitalist revolutionary turned out to be someone with beliefs as complicated and perhaps as conflicting as just about anybody else online. Memes, it seemed, had once again reduced someone to whom the internet wanted him to be, a reflection of their own frustrations with healthcare in the U.S. or the power of massive corporations. And I'll close on that.
Right on. So I'll mention that obviously there is another side to the coin, and I alluded to it earlier, but I'll just say it clearly in our as we kind of wind down this topic a little bit here. Insurers, from their perspective, like I remember, I listened to the current CEO of United Healthcare, and what he said is that their role in the process is to make sure that soaring costs are contained and that the overuse of care is contained. And people critical of that essential role that they play are really misinformed and are being sort of deluded or swayed or stoked by misinformation.
Oh, that's great PR. That's going to save more lives.
Right, right. So that they believe they serve an essential, and from their perspective, they do, right? They serve an essential role in the process. But other people have other opinions about how that process could be made better. And
so it's extreme. I'm telling you, it's extreme that they do it. They just see their job solely as to have their company pay less. Nothing else. That's all adjusters do. And that there's no fiduciary obligation to any of their insured. It's insane. But that's fine. That comment by the new executive, I mean, that just pisses me off. But go ahead. I'm not going to shoot anybody, though, I promise.
Yeah. I mean, we have time, so I think it's worth mentioning this, too. Right. So one of the areas of policy that's a little separate from this, but it's worth mentioning, is Medicare. Medicare is the system of care that it goes to senior citizens. As you know, all Americans are eligible. You reach that age, 64, and you've paid into it your whole life, and then your medical bills not every single penny of your medical bills, 80% of most expenses get covered by that plan. It's a right and privilege of being an American citizen. You pay into it, you get paid out. What a lot of people do is they buy this thing called Medigap insurance, which covers that 20% so that you have minimal out-of-pocket expenses on a monthly basis. I think for family members I've talked to, it used to be like $99 a month for Medicare, plus another, depending on who you are, $100 to $250 a month for that Medigap insurance, right? So that's a plan that transcends the private sector in design and theory, other than that Medigap. But what's happening in America now is that more than 55% of seniors have been sold a product called Medicare Advantage. Advantage is not Medicare. It's a privatization of Medicare that brings the cost containment principles of private healthcare into Medicare. This is a bigger conversation, and I'm just mentioning this because this is if you're a senior citizen and you now find yourself in that plan, you now are in a private plan. You're no longer in the plan that is an American citizen right. You're now in a cost containment model. And I think this larger conversation, like you and I have talked to people from Physicians United for a national healthcare plan, and we've talked to experts from the Nurses Union. There are a lot of people out there trying to explain to folks that we need a larger information session. We need a larger dialogue and deliberation. So the takeaway from this event is that this has resurfaced the contradictions and the absurdities. This death, and the message left at the scene is now a chance for people to kind of get out and say their piece. It's not just that it was a murder. It was more than that. It was a awakening of people that there is an obsession about profit in this sector of this giant sector of the economy. And in a country where people have very little sympathy, the lesson isn't, wait, murder's bad, right? Like, of course, murder's bad. We all agree murder's bad. No one wants people murdering each other. The lesson is, oh my goodness, look at how across all demographic groups, across all ages, races, religions, families, everybody has some anxiety about a system where people are being taken advantage of. And now is an opportunity for some solidarity to acknowledge that reality.
It is. I mean, the dynamics are this. Whenever the possibility of socialized medicine, single payer, or even just a public option, which if the private sector is so much better, they should have no problem competing against it, right? But they had Joe Lieberman kill that proposal from Obamacare. So there's no public option to insurance. And so whenever something like that is happening, they say, no, the private sector is the most efficient in the world, the market economy, blah, 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 where, we produce the best product. The government can't do that. And then when you actually want anything from them later, it's like, hey, we're trying to run a business here. We can't do that. So they admit that they can provide or they claim that they can provide. It's a borderline scam, and Medicare Advantage is a total scam. I think there should be people going to jail for that, but that's a whole other topic.
To be fair, there are other issues that need attention, but we really don't have a ton of time here. So we'll just have to wrap it up for today and just know that there'll be lots more to talk about in the coming days and weeks and months, like we said with the other issues today.
This brings us to predictions. What do you have, Dave?
So consistent with what I do from time to time, I'm going to comment on something we discussed briefly today. Since the fall of Syrian President Assad, there's been increased scrutiny of President-elect Trump's Director of National Intelligence nominee, former Representative Tulsi Gabbard. On Monday, 100 former national security officials signed a letter requesting that the Senate closely review her record on Syrian President Assad. Of primary concern is a visit she took there in 2017, particularly in light of the fact that Assad has now fled and his family have fled to live in exile in Moscow. And one quote that they said is, Gabbard, who served in the House for 8 years as a Democrat, has made remarks about the Russia-Ukraine war that were sympathetic to Moscow and echoed by Russian state news, which praised her nomination. So they want there's some scrutiny there. In response, there's been a letter from 250 Trump-aligned veterans and security professionals. They submitted their own letter to the Senate saying that Representative Gabbard has served her country honorably and is demonstrating a willingness to speak truth to power. My prediction is that the Senate Republicans will not be swayed by either letter and will instead defer to President-elect Trump's prerogative of choosing his own counsel, meaning Representative Gabbard will indeed be confirmed as the next director of national intelligence.
Okay. Real quickly, Florida has in the past a law and passed laws that are really draconian against immigrants. They no longer can have a driver's license, a number of other things that have just made it really unfriendly. Well, they got their wish. Immigrants are leaving Florida in large numbers because the racism is so toxic. And now all of a sudden businesses are freaking out. Wait a minute. Well, those laws were just political. It's not going to actually mean anything. And but, you know, you pass the laws, you pander to hate. This is what you got. Florida is losing its labor force because these are jobs, particularly on farms, that most Americans don't want. My prediction is that there is going to be a backlash from the business community against the anti-immigration policies, and Trump will find himself in a very difficult position and may have a hard time getting congressional support for all of his deportation policies. We'll find out if any of this comes true. Until next time, stay informed and stay engaged.